In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, you're listening to Politics on the Couch, a once regular, now occasional podcast that is part political analysis, part psychology, part therapy, and part, well, just me chatting to people who I find interesting. I'm Raphael Baer, by the way. For loyal listeners, the traditional apology. Yes, it has been a while. Sorry for the lack of podcast service. I don't even have the excuse of writing a book anymore, although I have been pleasantly surprised, touched in fact, by the number of people who have come up to me at events where I've been talking about the book to tell me how much they also like the podcast, and to ask when the next episode is coming out. So this one goes out to you guys. Thanks for waiting, and thanks for listening. And I hope it's worth the wait. What you're going to hear is a conversation that really goes to the heart of what I've been feeling about politics so far this year, and since October the 7th last year in particular, since the Hamas terrorist attack on Israel and the disturbing spiral of events it unleashed. I've written a couple of times in The Guardian about or around this subject and how it makes me feel as a liberal, secular British Jew. The temptation of news avoidance, the battle against downright despair, and the way events in the Middle East feed back into domestic politics in loops that seem to asphyxiate nuanced judgment and drown out any kind of perspective. And there aren't many people I would discuss this with on the podcast, or more specifically, there aren't many people I could actually imagine enjoying discussing this with on the podcast. But one of them is Jonathan Friedland, fellow Guardian columnist, much and deservedly acclaimed author, and also a podcaster. The excellent Unholy podcast, which Jonathan co-hosts with Yonit Levy of Israel Channel 12 News, all about Israel and the Jewish diaspora, recently won a silver medal at the New York Festival's Radio Awards. So mazel tov to them. As you'll probably hear in the conversation, Johnny and I know and understand each other pretty well. We've bonded about a lot of what I can best describe with the Yiddish word mashugas in politics. It literally means madness, but with a certain added cultural resonance of hand-wringing frustration. And so when I felt it was time for some podcast therapy, naturally I turned to Johnny. We don't just talk about Israel. Another reason I wanted to get him on the podcast is his expertise and fascination with American politics. He was a correspondent in Washington for many years, and back in the 90s, he wrote a very influential book about some of the things Britain could learn from US constitutional democracy, and I wondered how more recent events, the grim resilience of Donald Trump as a candidate and as a phenomenon, has changed his perspective. What you're about to hear is a conversation between two colleagues, friends, sitting on the couch, looking into the swirling, roiling mess of international affairs, trying to work out how bad it really is and how much of the dread we feel is analytical and how much is deeply personal. I found it a very helpful, even reassuring conversation. I hope you do too. Probably, I'm right in saying, the key point of affinity that brought us together politically and socially and culturally was that 2016 to 2020 period, and I wrote about it in the book, the crippling malaise and anxiety, which had two prongs, really. There was Corbyn and the Labour Party and anti-Semitism, and we'll come on to that. I want to park that for a moment. And then Brexit, Trump in the White House, the feeling that the foundations underneath liberal democracy were groaning and creaking, and everything might be sort of sliding towards an abyss. And here we are 4 years later, and many of those forces are still around. They've changed or they've been reconfigured. And I just kind of want to check in with you where we are in our, on the sort of the anxiety dial that flickers from green into orange into the red zone. And as I say, let's start with the right hand channel, as it were, of that dial, which was the nationalism, because how is it that Donald Trump is actually even still a proposition and a candidate? So yeah, where's your dial flicking at the moment?
Well, I find that the dial is comfortably in the green and amber, but I don't trust the meter, meaning that I think we're in that little lull, which, you know, in all those sort of dramas about the interwar years, they always show people sort of partying and enjoying themselves because they don't know what's about to come. And I say interwar years because we know there was one behind us, one period of turbulence and instability, which is the one you described. But the notion that another one is coming, and in a way, America and Trump is the right place to begin, because we're so, you know, unless we're mistaken, and I really hope we are, the polling and the sort of prognosticators tell us we are in this interregnum between the first Trump administration and the next one, and that we shouldn't, you know, mistake the current feeling of relative calm with the meter in the green and or light orange of Biden. We shouldn't miss the fact that the polling, etc., tells you that Donald Trump is going to come back. Now, I don't make that as a prediction, because I think actually, if you really put a gun to my head, I think he might well lose. But at the moment, he's ahead. The rational thing to do, on the, you know, the rational expectation, is to say we're going to have a second Trump presidency, and therefore all the churn, all the anxiety that you were describing and that you and I sort of lived through together could well be coming back, at least there. I mean, the question about Brexit and here is different.
And this is what I find fascinating about it, because in a sense, and this is what I think why I find stressful about it, it's not just that we got the relief of Biden winning and Trump losing, but there was an extra dimension of false promise to this, which was that the insurrection in January 2020 seemed to be such a profound vindication of what it was everyone had said about Trump, that actually it seemed that it was feasible that a bubble had actually burst, and that you would be able to get beyond the conversation about whether or not actually Trump represented something more serious or more profound about in American politics. He was a dangerous maniac, and everything his harshest critics had said about him was true, and that would, it would corrode the foundations. And so the fact that he's even competitive makes me worry that something in the character of the American Republic is fundamentally broken. And the reason, you know, I'd be interested in, particularly in your take on this, is because, you know, you wrote, I remember in the mid-90s, it was very influential, your book, Bringing Home the Revolution, the sense, you know, I see you as someone who is a deep tissue Americophile in constitutional terms. And so how much should we be grieving for the sort of the facts of American democracy, almost regardless of who wins in November?
Well, I think you formulated it the right way. The even that that Donald Trump is the nominee of to one of the two major parties, let alone ahead in many of the national polls, and, you know, it's statewide polls that matter more, but he's ahead in plenty of those too. Even that is an indictment of the state of American democracy. I completely think that. I went through a period, because you refer to this book of mine, incredibly 26 years ago now, and for a long period I was quite defensive about the proposition, because it did say, and you've identified it rightly, that Britain should import not, you know, every dot and comma of American life and culture, but very specifically the model of the Constitution, and that model was almost universal in its application, but had a particular fit with Britain, because the argument I made was it was designed with Britain in mind. The founders of the American Republic were all people who were ex-Brits or descended from Brits and crucially thought of themselves as Britons. If you actually look at the entire text of the Declaration of Independence, there's huge long screeds of it all about the reform of the House of Lords. You know, they thought they were doing something that was about the British polity. So I always felt that was ours. It was our revolution. Hence, we should bring it home. And so whenever something dysfunctional would happen in America, parenthesis, that was very often, I would feel the need to somehow explain it. Now, what I think is there were oversights in that constitution, which one could fail to see for a couple of centuries. There were other oversights that became glaring within the first century, of slavery being obviously the most clear, but other failings in there that only now in the era of Donald Trump have really become visible. And that is that it did not allow for, did not account for intense extreme partisanship. It just didn't imagine a model where somebody like Donald Trump could do something like the January 6th insurrection and all of Congress would unite to throw him out as a scoundrel. They thought that was obvious. And they just underestimated the power of party. And, you know, now it's a sort of meme on Twitter, partisanship is a powerful drug or whatever. The founders, I think, completely underestimated that. And they absolutely envisaged a strongman, would-be strongman like him. They pictured somebody who would want to be a monarch and an autocrat. In fact, they were very mindful, alive to that. Hence, Mr. President, you know, don't call him His Majesty. All of that. But they thought that elected officials in Congress would instantly throw him out. And they didn't. And a moment where I, you know, had that feeling of like the guy in the movie who, even though the superhero saved the world, then goes, till next time. You know, I felt like that day Mitch McConnell stood up and said, even though he thought Donald Trump was a danger and should be and was guilty of insurrection, he felt for procedural, very technical reasons, the Senate shouldn't acquit him, convict him. They should instead acquit. And therefore, he was going to get away with it. And McConnell said at the time, well, we'll now leave it to the judicial system. Well, we're seeing that play out now. And he shouldn't have done. It was a great mistake. It was the moment they let the danger, the menace, live on to fight another day.
And this raises something that I really ping-pong all over the place about, in terms of to what extent we in Britain both import and reflect a kind of parochial version of American politics. And there are sort of two dimensions to that. I mean, first of all, I think Rishi Sunak is not going to be prime minister this time next year. Also, if and when he loses the election, he will not sort of go to the car park outside a garden centre in Slough and say, actually, I won. There are so many ways in which it's sort of inconceivable that we would have an iteration, a UK iteration of American. And then you can list the ways in which we're just fundamentally different. You know, the NHS is untouchable. Socialized medicine is basically untouchable. We the evangelical Christian thing is so marginal. There are ways in which British politics is fundamentally European. And this comes up, you know, whenever you look at these, the sort of Farageist NatCon people who seem absolutely committed to transplanting a very radical Republican US iteration of conservatism into Britain and thinking it won't take. And that's great for Labour and great for progressive politics, because if they'll marginalize themselves and it's a 15% proposition and Labour will govern forever. And then the other part of me thinks, and yet there is this sort of sine wave synchronicity where you had Clinton and Blair, you had Brexit and Trump. It feels this kind of constant rhyming reiteration means that somehow we're just a few years behind whatever it is that the Republicans and Trump have done. It's coming our way one way or another. And that maybe is paranoid and irrational. And so I don't know how you feel about that.
Well, I think, you know, where... What I stopped on at the beginning, in your first question, was when you mentioned Brexit receding. And that's true. And I don't know whether this is just the lull that the heat of the 2016 wars, where we were in sync with the populist wave in the United States, exactly in line with that wave that you describe. I don't know if this means it's the tide has gone out and that's that. And it's now settled in some way, or if it's going to come back in you know, with a vengeance. And I was speaking with a conservative, former conservative cabinet minister just this week, who said, you know, the guessing game in Westminster has now become who takes over the Tories when they lose. And he made this really interesting point that it's very likely to be, he said, Priti Patel, which I hadn't thought of before, but he said she's the one figure all the different right-wing factions can unite around, and she would keep the seat warm for the return of Boris Johnson. You know, cue soundtrack, psycho violins at that point. You know.
Well, I actually had the sort of Doctor Who end of episodes, horrible. I'm not going to try and generate that noise into the microphone.
Yes, I do. You
know the one I mean. I mean, this terrible cliffhanger.
Now, I hadn't thought of that. That's what, in a way, that goes back to that sense of complacency I was speaking about before, about, you know, the meter says green, but do you trust it? You know, what if that's right? And what if our sine wave is Trump comes back and guess who? You know, that Starmer does one term. Labour governments used to be just one term long. That's not exceptional. And that suddenly they're back. So I think the menace of populism is not gone. We are, I think, in a lull. We can't be complacent about it. Instead, you've got to fight for it. You know, I'm keeping an eye as well on France and the expectation that many have there that Le Pen finally does win in the next presidential election there. In other words, there's plenty for people like you and me to be anxious about. There's no shortage. There's no shortage of worry. I do think, you know, if it wasn't for the war in the Middle East, which we may come on to, which is preoccupying me so much, I think my, you know, hours of being awake would be awake about the return of Donald Trump and what that means for populism around the world. Because, just maybe this is the last thing on this, that I would say, is that we did receive the Biden win of 2020 as a kind of endpoint. We thought that's the end of this phase of militant, aggressive nationalist populism. It's been defeated. And I'm not sure that was right.
Exactly. And we are definitely going to get onto the Middle East very shortly. And interestingly, the seg is sort of two things you said there that I think are very interesting. One, more than once, I think we've both used the word complacent and complacency. And then the feeling that Biden was a nice full stop, end of paragraph or end of chapter on a whole thing that happened. And the interesting thing, first of all, is that with Biden, although it's terribly unfair how hard a time he is given for being old, and he's not that much older than Donald Trump, I can't escape the feeling that something about his quite obvious decrepitude reflects a more, it is a metaphorical sense of the end of a whole post-war era, that he's sort of the incarnation of a senescent world order, that the best we can do is cling on to this old man who is somehow still 1950s to 1960s. Okay, 1970s are a bit nasty, but you know, that somehow 1945 through till 2024, as long as Joe Biden's still alive, the big remain impulse, and not just remain in terms of we wish we'd still, you know, could still be in the European Union, but sort of capital R remainism as a much broader liberal proposition about international rules-based order. The vulnerability of that seems to actually be expressed quite well, bizarrely, in Joe Biden, even though he's nothing to do with the European Union. And the reason this leads me to the sort of question of complacency is one of the things I found hardest to write about when I was writing my book touching on some of these themes was the tension between thinking, we, the liberal centre-left centrists, brought this on ourselves with complacency. There was a kind of how do you manage the slightly self-hating element of, you know, we didn't see the frustration in the Red Wall or in the flyover states, if it's in the US context. You know, we allowed ourselves to become part of a technocratic, arrogant governing consensus that invited the populist charge that, you know, establishment elites are out of touch. And yet also morally and politically, we're still right. I don't want to be sort of culturally self-loathing, but actually totally unrepentant in terms of what I actually believe. And then you layer on top of that, after the insurrection and Trump coming back, I'm thinking, okay, I'm done apologizing for liberal centrism. Like, there's no more excuses. The guy literally tried to overthrow the democratic constitutional order. How much more sort of paying your subs to the I'm a self-evidently a tyrant society and wearing the badge do you have to go through before you go, okay, the guy's a tyrant, you know, I'm fed up. I'm tired of trying to filter my liberal politics through empathy with people who are voting for a fascist. And that I'm kind of now in a bit of dead end.
It's so funny that point, that defensive sort of apologetic thing. It's because the label that was slapped on us and our equivalents in the United States was, you know, we were out of touch and we were meant to sort of go off and repent and sort of be in quiet reflection for all that we had failed to see. And yet you're right. The events that came along, the autocratic impulses of Donald Trump, who literally says when asked, you're not going to be a dictator, are you? Goes only on day one. You know, it's exactly what you're saying. They're telling us as loud as they can. He on the one hand, the failure of Brexit on the other. We want to also say, look, we were right. And maybe, and we end up sounding a bit like those old kind of government ministers who go, yes, if there was a criticism, it's of how we communicated our message. Remember, no government minister ever says the policy is wrong. It's how they communicated. And maybe that was true of, as it were, our end of politics. We sounded wrong. The vibe was wrong. The vibe was preachy and condescending and metropolitan, either Manhattan or London. And we didn't bring people with us. That I think we can definitely plead guilty to. But analytically, that Brexit would hobble the UK economy. We were right. That Donald Trump was cavalier, if not hell-bent on destroying the American Constitution. We were right. So I think that's it. But here's the thing I wanted to put to you and see what you think about this, because I'm thinking of your sine wave and the notion we're in sync. Is this a way to think about the way that the US and British politics might be in sync in a good way as follows, which is, Donald Trump, say, becomes president, and even if he doesn't formally do it, just by his vibes and rhetoric, essentially undermines NATO fatally and says, you can't rely anymore on the understanding that an attack on any NATO member is an attack on all of them. Therefore, NATO is essentially without America, because he's groveling after Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping, which is his preferred mode anyway. And then suddenly, the whole Brexit Europe issue looks completely different overnight. It suddenly becomes not an issue about, you know, phytosanitary conditions and trade barriers and tariffs. It becomes life and death. It becomes about a defense alliance. And at that point, are a whole lot of people, not the absolute Nigel Farage diehards, obviously, but others who did vote Leave and are still broadly okay about it or can't be bothered talking about it, do they return to this as an issue and say, okay, in a world where America isn't there anymore, we can't rely on it because Donald Trump is unreliable, at least, do we all need to come together as Europe, as the West, and bury our differences about, you know, qualified majority voting and actually be in a proper existential defence alliance? So I wonder if, in a funny way, the return of Trump, yes, it could mean we have Sue Ella Braverman politics here and we're in sync. But don't you think it might be, it could be, that actually it brings a revival for capital R Remainism?
Well, I think it certainly makes a compelling case already for the simple fact of Britain being self-evidently a European country. I mean, Donald Trump is not a popular figure in the UK. And interesting, for a column I wrote, I'll say, well, it's this week, but if people are listening to this podcast after this week, recently, I looked at where he is in the popularity stakes among British voters, and he's behind not just Joe Biden, but behind, you know, Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, Kamala Harris, Emmanuel Macron, Angela Merkel. And it's interesting, I had this conversation not long ago with a Labour frontbencher who's very engaged in Brexit policy, let's put it that way. And exactly this came up, and this person had to then slightly self-correct and say, oh, clearly I'm not in any way eagerly anticipating the idea of Trump winning so that the argument for Remain or for a pro-European strategic pivot in British foreign policy gets made. But it will be so obvious that that's what has to be done.
Ah, so they're already thinking about this. Good. I'm glad.
Very much
so.
Absolutely. They're more than thinking about it. I mean, the sort of tactical first step has already been taken in terms of flagging up that the first thing a Labour government would seek to do would be to negotiate a security and defence pact with the EU. I could get really into the weeds of both why that's the right way to start and why it's still a bit complicated, and it gets you into things like defense procurement, which we won't go to, but they definitely get it. That's the short version. I think where I worry about this, because I worry about everything, is actually, although there is, you know, be a compelling strategic argument for Britain's future is going to be, you know, as part of as part of Europe, because America is unreliable, it's not quite simple as that when you've got AUKUS, you've got Five Eyes, you've got the thickness of, and density of the US-UK security partnership is such that actually even a Labour Prime Minister, even Keir Starmer, would be under enormous pressure in December 2024 to say, well, we deal with the office of the president, will have to make it work with Donald Trump. It wouldn't be as simple as sort of articulating the moral case for we've sort of lost America and to the West. And it's very complicated. And this is where I think we get into the question of the Middle East.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Since October the 7th last year, I have a feeling that the sort of the spiraling towards some kind of much more cataclysmic conflict. You know, when you have Iran, not even by proxies, throwing cruise missiles at Israel, when you have a feeling that the, in quotes, Western alliance is lining up with Israel, but Israel is just, is not a popular cause in huge parts of the West and the rest of the world. That whole worldview that I've sort of carried around in my emotional psychological knapsack growing up, that basically from 1945 to the present day, although the West is, you know, gets some things wrong and you want to be able to criticize your government, it's a coherent, defensible and stable block defining a set of values and power in the world that I'm quite glad to be living in and don't expect to go away anytime soon, is completely over. That's the drain which we're spiraling towards. And that feels more profoundly disorienting as a sort of geostrategic moment than almost anything we've lived through in our lifetime.
Yeah. I mean,
that was a big proposition. Unpack any much of any of it that you like.
Yeah. I mean, it is big. And I think you're right about it. The frustration I feel about all this is it seems to me that all of those big geopolitical shifts are definitely there and can be analysed and can be grounds for legitimate panic in the way you've described. And yet, the same set of facts could be described in a completely different way were it not for one or two individuals to be off the scene and be replaced by others. So what do I mean here? As you and I are speaking, it's just a few days ago that Iran launched the attack you're describing. First time ever, directly Iranian territory onto Israel territory. The amount of ordnance that was unloaded was, I'm told by people who know these things, greater than the amount of firepower that the Kremlin unloaded onto Ukraine on the first night in that February 2022 assault. It was a shock and awe display of on a huge scale that should have taken out, you know, Israel's fighter planes, the F-35s, the Nevatim airbase, and caused huge loss of life. Why didn't they? Yes, because of Israel's relationship with America, which threw its, you know, missile defense systems at this problem, but also because, and you know, let's think about our lifetimes, you and me, also because Arab countries, Jordan, probably not confirmed, United Arab Emirates, probably Saudi Arabia, joined as well to protect Israel from attack. I mean, the reason why I say you think of our lifetimes is, you know, I remember as a six-year-old the Yom Kippur War. In other words, I remember one of those classic Arab-Israeli wars when multiple Arab nations ganged up together to invade Israel. And, you know, being with my own family in synagogue, as I could see ashen faces around where truly a generation who had grown up in the shadow of the Holocaust thought the state of Israel was about to be extinguished along with all its people. And now the Arab world, several countries, are in the air fighting to defend Israel. I mean, it's unbelievable how huge a historic shift that is. That's, in a way, the big story of last Saturday. Or it could be, if you had in power in Israel a prime minister who saw this huge strategic opportunity and said, this is the alliance I've always been talking about. This is the one that is partly there with the deals with Jordan and Egypt, but there with the Abraham Accords. It exists. And now it's material. It's turned into something real before our eyes. That's what they could do. If you didn't have a single individual there who is dependent on far-right, ultra-right, Kahanist, ultra-nationalist in his cabinet in the form of Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, and has to do whatever they want because he needs their votes to stay in power, which he needs to do to stay out of jail. Those small, contingent, parochial, petty, selfish considerations of one individual stand between, you know, us, the sort of human race, and a massive breakthrough in one of the most combustible regions in the world, and the most, perhaps. And that is so frustrating. Probably grew up sort of being told about, you know, to be wary of the great man theory of history, the history turns on these individuals. I don't know. The last few years are looking pretty good for the great man theory of history. Putin in Moscow, Trump in Washington, Netanyahu in Jerusalem, their whims and personality defects are enough to have massively changed the geopolitics. So I share your anxiety, but I also add to it a layer of frustration because it could so easily be the other way.
But this gets to the heart, I think, of, well, one of the organs of what makes the current situation in the Middle East sort of so pulsatingly anxiety provoking. I mean, I think for lots of people, but particularly for diaspora Jews watching it from the outside, which is that at the precise moment where the threat to Israel became so obviously existential, and at the moment where, as it were, Hamas really proved a point that things that defenders of Israel had been saying for such a long time, you know, are trying to articulate this point that don't you understand that what is opposing Israel here at core is an ideology that is committed to the annihilation, not just of the state of Israel, but of Jews and the state of Israel, because it contains half the world's Jewish population and frankly is connected to a wider Islamist ideology that would kill Jews wherever they are. And the point where that was illuminated for the world to see that might have actually pivoted an understanding of what's really at stake and why Israel behaves often the way it does, to the frustration of many people, including liberal Israelis and Jews in the diaspora. The person who had their hands on the levers of power at that moment was Netanyahu. And more to the point, it came right off the back of that period where on October the 6th, there was already a sense of almost, well, certainly for me, a kind of morbid dread because of all the judicial reforms and the arguments that were going on domestically in Israeli politics, that Netanyahu was already corroding and compromising the status of Israel as the one liberal democracy in the Middle East, which had always been the other part, or at least a significant part of its moral authority. That, you know, if Netanyahu was determined to turn Israel into something a bit more like Orbán's Hungary or Erdogan's Turkey, it just became that much harder in a diaspora to say, whatever else you say, this is the state you'd rather live in any of those neighboring states. This is the beacon of democracy in a region where democracy is really hard to come by. If the question is there a sort of mutation of what it means to even be the West that makes it so hard to actually distinguish who are the good guys and the bad guys. On top of that, you know, with Trump possibly coming back in the US, on top of that, there's something I can no longer get a clear purchase on what kind of country Israel will be in when all this is over, if and when it's over.
I mean, there were people who sort of heroically tried to say all the demonstrations about the judicial coup only went to show exactly how democratic Israel is. So that's all great. This has actually been healthy, they would say. And you know, I know what they meant. But now, in retrospect, because they were stopped, because partly by October 7th, but the government did, in order to bring in opposition parties into the war cabinet, part of that deal was, okay, we're going to freeze the judicial coup stuff. So now you can say, well, look, that was all quite healthy, wasn't it? Lots of demonstrations shows you what a vigorous democracy it was. Well, no, this was a country that was fighting to save its democracy from going the way of Orbán's Hungary and previously Poland. So it's not much of an advert. So I agree with you. The threat was very clearly there. On your point about the moment of sort of sympathy around the world, this is a thought I sort of wrestle with a bit, because it can sound like special pleading by a diaspora Jews. But Thomas Friedman wrote in the New York Times, why didn't Netanyahu just wait after October the 7th? A day, then another day, then a week, in 2 weeks, and let the pain of October 7th just sit there on the table of world opinion. So the world didn't have 5 minutes to contemplate the idea of Jews and Israelis as victims facing an annihilationist threat, but had to just stare it in the face and had to hear all the testimony that was coming out of the kibbutzim and hear about the sexual violence and the massacres. It had 5 minutes of global airtime before Israel was gearing up, saddling up for retaliation. And I wonder if I'm drawn to that thesis of Tom Friedman's, partly because it would have been so much easier for people who are associated with Israel on the outside, people like you and me, by just dint of being Jews. I have to sort of check myself and think, do I like that idea? Because it would have made for a quieter autumn for all of us. And then, but the pause I have is that, you know, there were people out in Sydney Harbour chanting "Gas the Jews" and people, crying genocide within hours of October the 7th, meaning they were accusing Israel of those things even before Israel had barely got over the instant shock that it was reeling from. It hadn't really done anything. And people were saying that. So I do sort of wonder about that. But
I think I'm with you on this, and I think there are two elements. One's just in terms of, as it were, the dispassionate political analytical answer to that proposition is, well, there are two. One is, I think there is a what has been identified as the sort of Millwall position in Israeli diplomacy, which is you've already accepted that no one likes and you don't care. That the assumption that somehow it would make a difference if Israel played to the role of the victim, and played is the wrong verb in that context, but you know, if you sort of amplified its victimhood in the hope that that would somehow achieve something diplomatically or strategically to Israel. First of all, no country does that. Almost the suggestion it should happen, and I can't even necessarily believe I'm making this case, but I think there's truth in it. Almost the suggestion that it should happen is a leaning into a kind of willing ownership of victimhood that I think certainly a lot of Israelis think is exactly the wrong response, the worst cultural trend that East European Jewry imported into Israel. This sense that the sort of hunch-shouldered, bowing, walking meekly to your own execution. Everyone loves the Jews when they're victims of Nazi aggression. And it's an image of Jewry that as gives them a sort of a happy moral beaconhood in the world. But it's also one where they get killed. And actually, I can see why a lot of Israelis and actually a lot of diaspora Jews go, you know what, how about there's a version of Jewish and Israeli identity that doesn't, where you can be right without also being killed.
Let's try that for a while.
And I have a certain sympathy with that view. Just to finish the point, actually you see the same thing now. I think it's quite interesting. I mean, I consider myself a sort of liberal left on all sorts of things and on foreign policy and in my attitude to the actions of the Israeli government. And, you know, I can very much see a rational, strategic reason why right now, I don't know what will happen by the time people listen to this podcast, Israel would be well advised not to go absolutely all in on a World War III provoking massive onslaught against Iran. It is also the case that there is no country in the world that realistically would receive the full ordnance cruise missile bigger than Russia on Ukraine barrage that was projected onto Israel and go, well, because other countries don't really like the way we behave, we should probably just sit quietly for a while. That is not actually a realistic or a reasonable thing to happen in international affairs in any other context, I don't think. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
Well, except though, when I thought you were going to say when you began that sentence, no other country would have this ordnance rained upon it and then have the United States come in and stop every single missile landing. And so that's, you know, Volodymyr Zelensky would love that. He didn't get that. The drones and the rockets landed, though, in that shock and awe attack of the Russians. So I want to push back in a way on the Millwall position, because I think that is the view that holds very strongly in Israel among regular Israelis, but also certainly with, you know, Netanyahu's coalition partners. And I would say that what the Saturday night, Sunday morning Iran attack revealed was nobody likes us, but you really have to care because you depend on it. And that's the thing. Israel, Netanyahu particularly, speaks a lot about, and funnily enough, it plays back to our Brexit discussion in an odd way, but he bangs on a lot about sovereignty. He goes on, and Ben-Gvir echoes it, says, Israel is a sovereign nation. We will make our own decisions. Well, all right then, make your own decisions and do it in a nice sovereign way alone. But as it is, you can't. You cannot defend yourself against that Iranian attack without allies. And those allies are the United States and, yes, of course, UK and France and those Arab nations, which is so significant. You need them. So what I would say sitting around, if I was sitting around that war cabinet table, is, yes, there are those military arguments about deterrence and appearing to be strong. And I'm very sympathetic to them. You've given the sort of cultural depth to those, which is that Jews must not be fair game in the world for people to hit Jews and not a Jewish country and not expect any comeback. But also, all of that is true. But there is another military fact on the table, and that is Israel cannot fight back alone. It needs its friends. Therefore, it has to act in such a way that it keeps and retains its friends. That, to me, is a military argument. It needs to do that. It's not some hand-wringing Amnesty International argument. It is a hard-headed military argument. You need access to Arrow 3. You need access to Iron Dome. You need access to David Sling, all these missile air defense systems. Fine. You then have to keep in with the Americans, with the Jordanians, with the other. You have to do that. And instead, there's a kind of macho delusion in Israeli policymaking, governmental circles, very analogous to the sort of Brexit imperial nostalgic delusion, which is we're a sovereign country, we can do whatever the hell we like, nobody can stop us. Well, actually, that's not the case.
When you talk about Israel having friends and allies, I find my ability to sort of disaggregate a political, diplomatic, analytical view of where Western countries' interests lie in their alliance with Israel, where that fits into my visceral identity-based status as a diaspora Jew, being both anxious for the existence of Israel and have family in Israel, and there are all sorts of cultural associations and attachments to the idea of Israel. But also, on top of that, the more self-interested feeling, which is when Israel is cast as a terrible villain on the international stage for all sorts of reasons, some justified, some not, it sort of blows back onto Jews and anti-Semitism everywhere else. And there was a brilliant episode of your podcast, Unholy, that you recorded with your Israeli co-host, where you really went into this in some detail, the misunderstanding and the miscommunication within a broad arc of solidarity between Israeli Jews and diaspora Jews, where the diaspora sort of feels that it ends up paying some of the bill for the actions of the Israeli government. And yet the Israelis feel they're the ones on the front line. It's not really, they're not taking any lessons from the diaspora on suffering. And it was a very important exposition of a very subtle tension that really resonated for me and a lot of people.
Well, I'm glad you say that. I mean, it certainly did seem to strike a chord with a lot of people. I think partly a lot of people operate on three levels. There were people, you know, there were diaspora Jews who came up to me and said, you voiced exactly what I felt. And Israeli Jews who came up to your needs and said, you voiced exactly what I felt. There was that. Then there were people who said, those arguments are exactly what's going on in my family. They would say, you know, I'm saying what you're saying, and my Israeli brother is saying what Yonit said, and we can't agree. And it was really helpful. We called the episode War Therapy. And people said, you know, it was therapeutic to hear the two of you air these things because we're having those same arguments. But the response that I sort of, in some ways, liked most, and which particularly resonated with me was the people who said, that sounded like the conversation I'm having inside my own head. That I'm hearing both of those things myself. And in fact, the conversation you and I have just had about, you know, you've got to be strong. They mustn't be the sort of, you know, hunched Jew of diaspora who just takes it and ends up dead. I don't know. I'm guessing here, but I think you and I could have swapped sides and swapped seats and had exactly the same conversation on a different day of the week. I hear exactly that argument. It presses on me too, the one you made, and maybe the one I was making is something you would be able to say. I think these go on inside us, and you know, the Jewish festival of Passover is approaching as we speak. A lot of families are apprehensive about being around the traditional Seder table, which is the, you know, for the first and second nights, where you retell the story of the Exodus, Jews escaping slavery. That is often a site of a time and a place of family arguments and discussion. And a lot of people are nervous about it because they can picture people arguing, you know, generationally, a younger generation that says, oh my God, these people starving in Gaza, this is just terrible. And an older generation that go, well, look, whatever Israel has to do to protect itself, you don't know what it's like, a world without Israel. You know, that argument. You know, I wrote something recently about this saying that argument, you don't even need a full Seder table. You could have a Seder table set for one and that argument will be going on because we feel all these things at once. And so what I was saying to Yonit in that episode was, yes, I'm so frustrated by some of the decisions Israel takes, but I also feel terrible guilt that there she is with and her fellow Israelis. They went for October the 7th. They were still living with the pain of it. And I'm popping up and going, look, it's really annoying the way that people are, you know, the way that your spokespeople are sounding on the Today program. Can you turn it down a bit? You know, and it's, I think you, as a diaspora, you should feel guilt about saying that, even if you feel the impulse.
Well, it's fascinating, isn't it? Because another dimension to this is, and this is definitely something I've encountered in my family and with Jewish friends, and sort of a footnote to that, what was very interesting is, since October the 7th, at some level, the extent, the reanimation, you know, just at a low level of a Jewish network of friends talking to people, because I probably had understood how deep it goes, but that feeling that when after that those attacks, after the atrocities, and particularly as you described, how quickly some people came out and sort of either maniacs and idiots on the left sort of saying this is a great moment of the, you know, of the heroic liberation struggle, you know, when before the bodies had even been buried, but also just more generally a feeling, certainly I got that, a slight feeling I got that there were people again on the left who had maybe sort of dabbled in the more anti-Semitic shades of anti-Zionism and had been very sympathetic to the Jeremy Corbyn project and had thought that was all a bit of the charge of anti-Semitism around Corbyn was a smear and, but they weren't sort of full blown Nazi meme sharing anti-Semites. They were just sort of sympathetic to, or at least confused, in maybe the generous way of putting it, about the difference between being fanatically anti-Zionist and where that shades into just using old anti-Semitic tropes. Anyway, the point, there was a moment where when Corbyn was completely defeated, Starmer takes over the Labour Party, it becomes more sort of recognized that actually there really was a problem here with anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. People really need to actually adjust their positions, think a little bit about their language, think about where they got themselves to. And then suddenly, in the sort of aftermath of October 7th and in the once the IDF are in full military engagement in Gaza, a huge section of the left gets to go, oh, right, well, that's fine, right, it's open season now, right, phew, I'm glad we don't have to pretend to not just hate Israel and Zionism, open brackets, and Jews, close brackets, like the old days. And so that feeling that actually, as it were, you know, all this hard-won progress in unpacking some of those issues and actually, you know, getting to potentially quite a good place on anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism, you know, how these things fit together, it all sort of went up in smoke. And I felt, if I'm honest, that I didn't even want to talk about it anymore to non-Jews. It wasn't a conversation I felt able to have anymore because I was just too tired of being back there again.
Do you not think, though, it's possible that what you articulated there is too pessimistic in the sense that it glums onto the very loud voices on Twitter and so on, who I, by the way, recognize in your description, which is those people who were sort of waiting. They had this pent up urge to get back into the very, into the comfort zone of whacking Israel brackets and also Jews if necessary. And they had to, felt they were sitting there in the corner of the room, you know, on in detention, having to bite their tongue. And suddenly they were, you know, the bell rang and they were back out, allowed to run back out into the playground and enjoy themselves again. That may be true of some of those people. And we could, you know, if we didn't fear the learned gentleman, we would, you know, and the law, we could name some of them. But I think that's true of those people on Twitter. But you think about the Labour Party, which is about to perhaps, it seems, be the government of this country. And under extraordinary pressure, they did not revert to, you know, 2017 to 19. They have held some kind of line, which is incredibly difficult. It's very difficult to maintain the position that the idea of Israel is okay when the reality at the moment is so depressing. And yet the people of, you know, who make the decisions, the Keir Starmers, the David Lammys of this world, and in America too, Joe Biden and, you know, the entire United States government, they haven't, you know, defaulted back to the sort of, you know, the Twitter position. So I sometimes think that we attach too much weight to some of that kind of noise and chatter, social media conversation, and read in too much. Were there people who felt as if they had been scolded and admonished by the Corbyn years and had to sort of be on best behavior and now felt they had license to unload? Yes. Do those people matter as much as we thought? I think not. They were there before. They were there before the Corbyn period. We were right to worry about them in the Corbyn period because guess what? They were suddenly right in the circle of a man who would be prime minister. That was a different problem. But now they're back to where they are. And I think in a way we've got to sort of learn to see them in with a sense of proportion. And then the last thing, which I'll just throw back to you because it's something I think you have said about Brexit and Bolshevism in the sense that there are Brexiters who go, well, the real Brexit's never been tried. You know, pure Brexit's never been done. And so, yes, this Brexit is awful, but the idea itself remains pristine. And you compare them to those old, you know, communists who would say, well, Moscow is awful and North Korea is awful, but real communism's never been tried. As if to say, you know, what a intellectually spurious position. Conscience. I sometimes do wonder about the idea of a Jewish homeland where you, people like you and me, want to argue that yes, what's going on now is awful. Netanyahu, awful. Ben Gvir, appalling. Smotrich, the occupation, all of it. But the idea that Jews have a home of their own is still a legitimate idea. Do you think we sound at all like the Brexiters who say pure Brexit's never been tried yet, or the Bolsheviks who say actual Marxism and Leninism has never been tried yet, and the form you see now may be ugly, but the reality could be great?
That's such an interesting question. You've articulated something that I think has been half formed in the back of my head for a while, and I was going to actually almost ask you the same question or a variant of the same question, and I know we're running out of time, but I you know, obviously I don't want that to be the case, or certainly I don't think it is, because it's not unreasonable that there is a country that is Israel where, you know, we get into the sort of what the borders would be and whether it's 1947, 48, 67, yeah. We definitely don't want to go down that kind of worms. What I do think as an essential component of what the state of Israel was meant to do was to gather in the Jews. And the idea was that the diaspora at some point would, you know, we used the term make aliyah, you'd go and you'd live there. Now, clearly that's not going to happen. So in a way, using your Brexit analogy, you know, the diaspora Jews want to have their cake and eat it. So they want an idea of Israel that is somehow above and separate to other types of countries, because it gets to, you know, has a claim on your identity, but it's not a country you've left or are going to. It's not the old country as in you emigrated from it, and it's not that type of identity. It has a purchase on the story you tell about who you are, and yet you don't have any intention of living there or sort of, you know, you don't participate in the civic life of that country. And the further out you get from 1947, 1948, the more abstract and detached from the actual Israel that is. One of the things that people who defend modern Israel often say to its critics, whether they're sort of friendly critics, reasonable critics, unhinged, mad, people who want to delegitimize the state of Israel, and we know that's a broad spectrum, is the thing you're describing as Israel, I don't recognize as the place I go to. It's a liberal, it's the one country in the Middle East that has the best record on LGBT rights. It's, you know, as we've said earlier, it's a democracy. It's a multicultural society. It's a multi-ethnic society. It's, you know, it's not the thing that its critics like to present it as. But actually, in a sense, it's also not the thing the diaspora has in its head as a sort of theoretical notion of what Israel it would like to be. And yes, that I think, just by the operation of time alone, it is almost self-evidently going to happen. And the last point I'd say on this is, it does remind me a little bit, actually, when I was a correspondent in Riga, and there were a lot of ethnic Latvians who left Latvia when it was reoccupied by the Red Army in 1944-45. And they went off and lived in Canada, sometimes in Argentina. Some of them were sort of SS collaborators. Some of them were just Latvians who didn't want to live under the Red Army, and they kept alive this idea of Latvia when under Soviet occupation, and then they went back to rebuild independent Latvia in 1991, newly restored independent Latvia in 1991, and there were terrible tensions between those people and the people who actually lived there, because they said, you've got this idea of Latvia and you've been going to your Latvian language summer camps in Canada and you have no idea what it was like being actually Latvian in the Soviet Union. And I think something, yeah, and that was actually a relatively short period of time. So the short answer to your question is, at some level, I think, yes, that is a thing.
Yeah, it's an extra burden on Israel to be an idea as well as a place. And that is very hard. And it's hard to think of many countries, if any, that carry that weight, I think.
Now, we are now out of time, but it is also traditional on the podcast. And this is probably the hardest one I've possibly done on this for this particular segment, where we finish on an optimistic note. But I'm sensing you, maybe it's your temperament, you've pushed back against some of my gloomier prognostications. So if your dial isn't in the amber, in the red, on what basis would you talk me back down a little bit into the green right now?
Well, specifically on the hardest one first, on the one we've just been talking about Israel-Palestine, there I find it very hard to be optimistic about the immediate term. But there's a very good man called Daniel Seideman, who's the expert really in the world on Jerusalem, on what's happening in Jerusalem, street by street, block by block. And he says of a two-state solution that it is simultaneously a political impossibility at the moment, but also a historic inevitability. And he said the challenge for politics is to make the bridge from political impossibility to historic inevitability. In other words, there is no other way this will be resolved. Some way or other, it will be eventually a two-state solution. There will be a state of Israel alongside a state of Palestine. It has to be. There's no other way. Our job is to get from here to there, even though here at the moment looks entirely impossible. I like that because it accommodates, it builds in the gloom and pessimism and the realism in a way, because right now there are so many obstacles. You don't get any prizes for rattling off all the reasons why two states can't happen. But he takes comfort in the historic inevitability. And I would link that with another thought, which is about patience, which I find very difficult, But I interviewed, I think I've told you about this, the brilliant Israeli novelist, writer, veteran, peace activist, Amos Oz, now no longer with us, many, many times over my own life, over a period of decades. And in our penultimate conversation, I said to him, so you've worked 50 years for a two-state solution and there is no sign of it. Is it time for you to give up and think of something else, a different option? And he said, no, why would I do that? He said, you're in Europe where you fought wars of religion for what, 500 years, 600 years? It's only now that you have got relative stability. And I was thinking, even when he said it, well, it really is only now. This, and we were talking, you know, what, 50, 60, 70 years after the end of the Second World War. Why do you assume that we will solve this overnight? He died 2 years after that. Those were the words of someone who had given up on saying this will be solved in my lifetime. He understood it wouldn't be. But he found a way to be at peace with the with his own impatience and to realize, okay, this may take longer. I may not get to see it, but we will get there. And so I find that there is a kind of arrogance in wanting this solved now on my in my timescale. It's like you're tapping your watch face and thinking, you know, let's get on with it. It may not happen in the next couple of decades in the way that in my 20s and 30s and 40s, I absolutely assumed it would be. It may not, but I think it has to end there because, you know, there is something in that notion of the arc of the universe bending towards justice. You know, it looks every day like it bends towards injustice. But this is one of those problems that only, I think, has this. It can only be resolved that one way. And eventually we will get there. Politically impossible now, but historically inevitable.
So, yeah, I'll take that. I'll take that and I won't push back. We're not going to excavate some gloomy counterviews because I think let's leave the let's let the camera pan out far enough to the horizon where we can see the light. On which note, Jonathan Friedland. Johnny, thank you very much.
Thank you, Raf. I've enjoyed it.
Hi, I'm Phil, the producer. Thanks very much indeed for listening to Politics on the Couch. In our show notes for this episode, we've got links to the two podcasts Jonathan Friedland regularly hosts and also links to the three writers he mentions. I've also put in some links for some forthcoming live events Raf Baer is taking part in that are not connected to this podcast, but sound fascinating. Hope you enjoy this episode. I'm Philip Berman. Until next time.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.